Okay, we're finally able to start Judith after a couple of false starts there with the weather and stuff. Before we, let's see, okay, Mary Beeler's coming on. Before we actually get into the text, I'm going to go back for just a second and look at that slide 35 that shows what the big complaint is about the different books. And so I'm going to share my screen and then go look at that particular thing. Let me see what I'm doing here. Yeah. Got to use my eyes. It says share screen. And then we're going to go to slide 35. So this is the one that talks about what the big complaint is about the deuterocanonical books. And so what they complain about is they say that Judith and Tobit have erroneous geography and history. Well, they tell you right off it's not a history book. It's a spiritual story. Okay. And then in Judith, it said God forbids lying, and Judith and the angel Raphael provide sinful examples by giving false information. And that's in Judith chapter 9 and verses 10 and 13. We'll look at that when we get to chapter 9. I think you'll probably agree that you would do the same thing she did. So that's the big complaint about Judith. Erroneous geography, and she told, and they characterize it as a sinful example of lying. And if this is sinful, then nobody in their sphere of influence could ever work for the Mossad or the CIA or anybody else. Because what Judith is doing is talking about how she's going to try to deceive these people that are on the verge of coming in and destroying Israel, and how she was going to save Israel. And she prays to the Lord to help her. So I'm not sure how you classify that as sinful. But anyway, that's what the big complaint is. So we'll look at chapter 9 when we get there and see what all this big sinful lying is all about. So we begin Judith. It is, of course, one of the deuterocanonical books. And it's an expression. The authors of the Navarre version talk about, you know, what the purpose of this book was. And it says an expression of hope in God. You know, when everything looks like it's lost and you're about to go down, you have hope in God, who does not forget his people, particularly when they are in difficulty. And it comes to their rescue when he is invoked with an upright heart. So if you have an upright heart like Judith did, and you go to him and say, you know, I need your help, and you know, I got to save Israel, and I need your help to do that. These are your chosen people, and they're about to get destroyed by these enemies of Israel. So the book is divided basically into two parts. The first part talks about how Israel is beset by a powerful enemy. This big army is ready to come right in and destroy it. And there's a big general, Holofernes, who is the general for Nebuchadnezzar, and he's got this big reputation about being invincible and how he's going to come in and just destroy the whole nation of Israel. He's going to destroy the town that Judith lives in, which is like a barrier town for Jerusalem. He plans to go through that town and then take Jerusalem and destroy it. The other part of this story is where God confounds his enemies through the actions of Judith. It shows what she does to confound all these enemies, which are it's a huge army, and they couldn't begin to match them, you know, on the battlefield person for person. It's just too numerous. But it talks about how through her stealth she was able to get in and totally demoralize the enemies and then save Israel. And so that's kind of the framework for the story. They say it's difficult to say exactly when the book was written because its literary genre is so unusual that the story itself provides no reliable points of reference. It speaks of Nebuchadnezzar as the king of Nineveh, is reigning shortly after the Jews returned from exile and rebuilt the temple, whereas in fact Nebuchadnezzar was king of Babylon, and it was he who sent the Jews into exile. So there's a little confusion about geography and personalities and stuff like this. But the point of the story is that God comes to the aid of the people who trust in him. And so Judith is a perfect example of that. They also have it's also a story of the fight of good versus evil, because they refer to Nebuchadnezzar as a god. The king Nebuchadnezzar is a god, and the general refers to him as a god. And so it's the idea of this false god, which represents Satan and everything that's wrong, and of course Judith paying homage to the real God and asking for his help to defeat the enemy. So it's when you look at the story as we go through it, it really reminded me a lot of the Lord of the Rings, when you had that huge army, you know, those horrible looking creatures, and they were fighting against the good guys. Or even going back to the Wizard of Oz, when you had the flying monkeys and the Wicked Witch of the West against the good people. You know, it's that same kind of story, same kind of battle of good versus evil. A God taking care of his people that rely on him with a clean heart. And then Judith, again, just like in Tobit, Judith approaches this problem in prayer. So Judith's prayer to the Lord holds the theological key to the whole book. He who had sought to seduce Israel and lead her into idolatry is himself seduced and vanquished. Whereas those who are true to their commitments to God can always count on the Lord's fidelity. So the entire story sends a message of hope in the God of Israel, who guides the course of his people's history. But they have to remain faithful to him. Every time they go away from him and start falling into idolatry and stuff, he backs away from them. And so that's kind of where we are here. So Judith symbolizes faith, whereas Holofernes, which is the general for the enemies, epitomizes force. So it's faith versus force, faith versus power. Judith has no weapons, nor is she skilled in their use, but she is resourceful and strong, and thanks to her trust in God. These two characters are a paradigm of the difference between those who rely on human power and those who hope in God. It's the same teaching as given in Psalm 20, which says that some boast of chariots and some of horses, but we boast of the name of the Lord our God. Judith is beautiful and wise. She is a model of the woman endowed with the wisdom that gives her faith and confidence in God far beyond any normal human wisdom, be it Babylonian or Greek. But above all, she is a model of the devout person who undertakes a risk in order to help her or his brethren. So she's doing all this to help her people, not just to help herself. And so that's kind of the theme of this whole story. It says, even though human logic would lead one to think that the world is at the mercy of the powerful, the book of Judith invites us to use the logic of God, of which St. Paul says, God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothingness things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. So we should never boast and think we're the big cheese. You know, we're the ones with all the power. Because it's not, we're not, it's God. But he says, however, faith in God does not exclude the need for man to play his part. So according to this story, the defeat of the Assyrians results from the resourcefulness of Judith and not from any spectacular intervention by God. So God doesn't come down like he did at Sodom and Gomorrah and just throw fire and brimstone at the enemy. He uses Judith as his instrument to defeat the enemy. So she's got to use her intelligence, her looks, her resourcefulness to defeat the enemy. She cleverly uses all the resources available to her, and God enables her to succeed in an enterprise which, humanly speaking, would seem doomed to fail. She's just one woman going up against this huge army, and so you would think it would naturally fail, but she doesn't fail. The fathers of the church have seen the book of Judith as an example of the providence of God, just like we saw in Tobit as well, who never leaves his people unprotected. Their writings, like the book of Judith, are very aware of God's preference for what is humble, for what seems of no account, in order to bring to nothing that which seems to be very strong. Here, a woman who is weaker than man as far as physical strength goes, proves to be stronger on account of her valor and her reliance on God. She is also seen as a model of various virtues. She's an example of courage, of chastity, of trusting, prayer in God. And on account of her firmness in rejecting suitors, she's a model for widows who decide to dedicate their lives to God. Somebody else is coming on. Oh, Elsie's coming on. And so that's kind of the background for this story of Judith. So in the beginning of this, of the book, we'll go into the book itself now. It talks about what it is that the Israelite people are up against. What is this force that's coming in? It says, in the 12th year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, who ruled over the Assyrians and the great city of Nineveh, in the days of Araxfed, who ruled over the Medes and Ecbatania, he's the king who built walls around Ecbatana with hewn stones, 3 cubits thick and 6 cubits long. He made the walls 70 cubits high, so he's built this big fortress around his town. And he made his gates, which were 70 cubits high and 40 cubits wide, so that his armies could march out in force and his infantry form their ranks. It was in those days that King Nebuchadnezzar made war against this king in the great plain which is on the borders of Ragay. He was joined by all the people of the hill country and all those who lived along the Euphrates and the Tigris and the Haida Hadesperes. So they're talking about this king had built this huge fortress with these real big strong walls, big strong gates and everything else. And Nebuchadnezzar is going to come in and just destroy this guy. And so what the point they're making is that no matter how strong you are, Nebuchadnezzar is going to win. He's going to come in and take over everything. So basically, in his mind, in Nebuchadnezzar's mind, the Israelites have no chance because they don't have a place with walls like this guy had. Okay. So they're talking about this guy here. He says, many nations joined the forces of the Chaldeans. Then Nebuchadnezzar, king of the Assyrians, sent to all who lived in Persia and to all who lived in the west, those who lived in Sicilia and Damascus and Lebanon and Telebinon, and all who lived along the seacoast and among the nations of Carmel and Gilead and Upper Galilee and the great plains of Esdraelon, and all who were in Samaria and its surrounding towns. Boy, so many things are hard to pronounce. And beyond the Jordan, as far as Jerusalem and Bethany and Chalus and Kadesh and the river of Egypt, and the Tophanes and the Ramses and the whole land of Goshen, even beyond Tamis and Memphis, and all who lived in Egypt as far as the borders of Ethiopia. But all who lived in the whole region disregarded the orders of Nebuchadnezzar. So he was trying to gather the largest army he could. So he sends a message to all these different people that we just talked about, saying, join my army, and we're going to, you know, take over the world kind of thing. And they refused to join him. So he got really mad at them. So we're going to see that eventually he's going to want to take vengeance against them for refusing to join him. But they refused to join him in the war, for they were not afraid of him, but looked upon him as only one man. And they sent back his messengers empty-handed and shamefaced. So he got very angry with the whole region and swore by his throne and kingdom that he would surely take revenge on the whole territory of Sicily and Damascus and Syria, and that he would kill them by the sword, and also all the inhabitants of the land of Moab and the people of Ammon and all of Judea and everyone in Egypt as far as the coasts of the two seas. So this guy is really, you know, he really thinks very highly of himself and his power. So he's saying, I'm this big, powerful king, and I'm going to just walk in there and just take over. Even if these people don't want to join me, I'm going to do it anyway, and then I'm going to wipe out them as well. So he's just ready to just take on everybody. He thinks he's so great and so powerful. And so it says, in the 17th year, he led his forces against the king of Arphaxad. That's the guy that built that big fortress with the big thick walls and all. He led his forces against that king and defeated him in battle and overthrew the whole army of Arphaxad and all his cavalry and all his chariots. Thus he took possession of his cities and came to Ecbatana, captured its towers, plundered its markets, and turned its beauty into shame. He captured Arphaxad in the mountains of Rage and struck him down with hunting spears. So he went and found the king that was hiding and killed the king too. And he utterly destroyed him to this day. Then he returned with them to Nineveh, he and all his combined forces, a vast body of troops, and there he and his forces rested and feasted for 120 days. So that's the background behind what he's done as he gets ready to take on Israel. So he's this big, strong guy, took on this very powerful king, had a big fortress, and he wiped him out, found the king, and killed him. So he has no mercy on anybody. So now we're going to get into the campaign against Israel. And the notes that they have here for the first chapter. So the enemy is portrayed as an amalgam of the powers that caused the fall of Israel and later of Judah. The mighty might of Assyria. Remember they had the Assyrian exile? Well, they're talking, that's kind of what they're referring to here, the Assyrian exile. The military might of Assyria, which is talked about in 2 Kings chapter 17. And the overweening pride of Babylon. Of course, they had the Babylonian exile as well, which is referenced in 2 Kings 24 and 25. Nebuchadnezzar was not, in fact, the king of the Assyrians in Nineveh, but he was the prototype of the powerful, tyrannical, proud ruler. The sacred author who is writing a story to convey a message and is not very interested in history or chronology uses Nebuchadnezzar as a symbol for the despotic Seleucids who dominated the Jews when this book was being written. The monarch described here is depicted as a proud and powerful king whose rule is expanding right across the Middle East. First, he attacks King Arphaxad, whose power is indicated by the size of the walls around his capital. Nebuchadnezzar tried to get allies to join him in the siege, but he failed to do so and resolved to take revenge for this in due course. But his army, in fact, took Ecbatana on its own, which serves to show how strong the army actually was. So those are their notes going into chapter 2. So Holofernes This is about his campaign. Holofernes is the head general of the entire army of Nebuchadnezzar. So chapter 2 says, in the 18th year, on the 22nd day of the first month, there was talk in the palace of Nebuchadnezzar, king of the Assyrians, about carrying out his revenge on the whole region. The revenge against all those people that refused to join his army. And the notes they have here about this second chapter say that in search of revenge, Nebuchadnezzar sends Holofernes, his commander-in-chief, on a punitive campaign. It wasn't just a campaign to fight an enemy. It was a punitive campaign to punish those who refused to join him. The 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar was 587 BC, the very year when Babylonian troops took over Jerusalem, profaned the temple, and set it on fire, and deported part of the population, as described in Jeremiah chapter 52. The date is highly symbolic. For the sacred writer, the destruction of the temple of Jerusalem implied that Nebuchadnezzar was assuming the prerogatives of divinity, as can also be seen from the fact that he calls himself Lord of the whole earth, and of course his general also refers to him as a god. Holofernes assembles a huge army, sets out on his campaign of destruction and death. The order to he makes an order to prepare, as we'll see in a couple of seconds here, he prepares an order to prepare earth and water. That's a quote. Prepare earth and water. It's a Persian expression that means everything necessary for a conquering army to move in and establish itself in a country. So Nebuchadnezzar's intention was to seize these people's territories. Even those who did not resist him were subject to his wrath, the worst aspect of which was that they were forced to worship Nebuchadnezzar and invoke him as a god. Therefore, the danger that threatened Jerusalem was particularly insidious. Not only might its inhabitants be killed or made subject to a foreign power, but they could be forced to render to a man the worship that was only due to God. During the period when the Seleucid kings dominated Judea, the first half of the 2nd century BC, the sort of situation described in the Book of Judith was very much the order of the day: military oppression and attempts to impose king worship. The route of the marsh described in the second chapter and the third chapter of Judith is geographically impossible. The author is exaggerating the feats of Holofernes to prepare the ground for the religious message he wants to convey. So that's the notes leading into chapter 2. So in chapter 2 begins where they're talking about Holofernes conducting this revengeful campaign against the whole region. And he said he called together all his officers and all his nobles and set forth to them his secret plan and recounted fully with his own lips all the weaknesses of the region. And it was decided that everyone who had not obeyed his command should be destroyed. When he had finished setting forth his plan, Nebuchadnezzar, king of the Assyrians, called Holofernes, the chief general of his army, second only to himself, and said to him, so you see how Nebuchadnezzar's pride is controlling all of his thought process. He's very prideful, thinks of himself as a god, thinks he's invincible. And so now he's given his instructions to the general. He says, "Thus says the great king, the Lord of the whole earth." So he's already claiming that he's the Lord of the whole earth. "When you leave my presence, take with you men confident in their strength to the number of 100, 120,000 foot soldiers and 12,000 cavalry. Go and attack the whole west country because they disobeyed my orders. Tell them to prepare earth and water." That's the expression again.
Excuse me.
some water here. So go and prepare earth and water. For I am coming against them in my anger, and will cover the whole face of the earth with the feet of my enemies, of my armies. Excuse me. And will hand them over to be plundered by my troops. To their wounded shall fill their valleys, and every brook and river shall be filled with their dead and overflow. And I will lead them away captive to the ends of the whole earth. So now he's not only saying he's going to be king of Lord of the region, but Lord of the entire earth. So this guy's really full of himself. And he's trying to take on those divine... Yeah, he's trying to take on those divine characteristics. You know, so you can see where he would be full of pride, which was the downfall of Satan. And so that's the opposite of what God looks for. He looks for humility in all of us. He says, you shall go down and seize all their territory for me in advance. They will yield themselves to you, and you shall hold them for me until the day of their punishment. But if they refuse, your eye shall not spare, and you shall hand them over to slaughter and plunder throughout your whole region. For as I live and by the power of my kingdom, what I have spoken, my hand will execute. Kind of sounds like the movie The Ten Commandments, where the Pharaoh says, what I have said, what I've written, what it shall be done, or whatever Yul Brynner was saying all the time. So I have said, so it shall be done, or whatever that famous phrase was that he used in the movie. It's the kind of same kind of thing we're seeing here. What I have spoken, my hand will execute. And you, take care not to transgress any of your sovereign's commands, but be sure to carry them out just as I have ordered you, and do not delay about it. So he's threatening his general that he's going to put in charge of all this, saying, you better do exactly what I tell you, or else. So Holofernes left the presence of his master and called together all the commanders, generals, and officers of the Assyrian army, and mustered the picked troops by divisions, as his lord had ordered him to do. 120,000 men, together with 12,000 archers on horseback, and he organized them as a great army, marshaling for a campaign. He collected a vast number of camels and asses and mules for transport, because he's going to transport stuff with him for supplies, but also take the plunder and transport that back. And innumerable sheep and oxen and goats for provision. So he wants to be well fed. Also plenty of food for every man and a huge amount of gold and silver from the royal palace. So he set out with his whole army to go ahead of the king to cover the whole face of the earth to the west with their chariots and soldiers and infantry. Along with them went a mixed crowd like a swarm of locusts, like the dust of the earth, a multitude that could not be counted. So they marched for 3 days from Nineveh to the plain of Bechteleth and camped opposite Bechteleth near the mountain which is to the north of Upper Sicilia. From there Holofernes took his whole army, his infantry, cavalry, and chariots, and went up into the hill country and ravaged Put and Lud and plundered all the people of Rhasis and the Ishmaelites who lived along the desert south of the country of the Chaldeans. The Ishmaelites, of course, were the descendants of Ishmael, who was Abraham's son by the slave of his wife. He was also the founder of Islam. Then he followed the Euphrates, and passed through Mesopotamia, destroyed all the hilltop cities along the brook Abernus as far as the sea. So he's wiping out everything in his path. He's just marching through like a herd of locusts, killing everybody, wiping out all the cities. Remember, it's a punitive campaign he's on. He's not just there to try to, you know, win over some other people. He's punishing people. He also seized the territory of Sicilia and killed everyone who resisted him. And then came to Japheth, fronting toward Arabia. He surrounded all the Midianites and burned their tents and plundered their sheepfolds. Then he went down into the plain of Damascus during the wheat harvest and burned all their fields and destroyed their flocks and herds and sacked their cities and ravaged their lands and put to death all their young men with the edge of the sword. He didn't want anybody of fighting age to be able to resist him. So he killed all the possible soldiers. So fear and terror fell upon him, fell upon all the people who lived along the seacoast of Sidon and Tyre, and Sur and Osina, and all who lived in Jamnia, those who lived in Azotus and Escalon. Everybody feared him exceedingly. So they're all scared of this guy. They don't know what to do, you know? Mary, go ahead. Mary, you had a comment? Nope, guess not. So they sent messengers to sue for peace. They were trying to say, what can we do to keep you from just slaughtering us? Behold, we the servants of Nebuchadnezzar. So they go in to the general, and the first thing they do is claim themselves as servants of Nebuchadnezzar. So they're trying to appease him so he doesn't kill them. They sent messengers to sue for peace and said, behold, we, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, the great king, lie prostrate before you. Do with us whatever you will. Behold, our buildings and all of our land and all of our wheat fields and our flocks and herds, etc., lie before you. Do with them whatever you please. Our cities also and their inhabitants are your slaves. Come and deal with them in any way that seems good to you. So the men came to Holofernes and told him all this. Then he went down to the seacoast with his army and stationed garrisons in the hilltop cities and took picked men from them as his allies. And these people and all the country round about welcomed him with garlands and dances and tambourines, and he demolished all their shrines and cut down their sacred groves. For it had been given to him to destroy all the gods of the land, so that all nations should worship Nebuchadnezzar only, and all their tongues and tribes should call upon him as God. So he's really making a point of making Nebuchadnezzar some kind of divine being, which is kind of what the Roman emperors did too, if you remember. He used to call it Divine Caesar. Yeah. Then he came to the edge of Esdraelon, near Dothan, fronting the great ridge of Judea. So now he's about to get to Israel. He's fronting the great ridge of Judea. Here he camped between Geba and Scythopolis, and remained for a whole month in order to assemble all the supplies for his army. So he's sitting there for a month. The Israelites have a month to watch what he's doing and try to plan what they're going to do. So Judah is now on alert. So at the beginning of chapter 4 here, the notes they have on 4 say that the Israelites are terrified when they hear of Holofernes' advance, and they take steps to resist him, establishing fortresses, stockpiling provisions, and stationing their men in strategic positions. But they also try to win God's help by means of prayer and penance. The book's clear message becomes ever more clear. This is primarily a struggle about religion. The enemy army symbolizes the huge impiety and pride of someone who thinks he is almighty and has no need for God, whereas the sons of Israel are devout men who know full well that their strength can come from God alone, and that prayer is the best way to acknowledge their dependence on God. And then around verse 6, it says, there is no geographical evidence that Bethulia actually existed. What we have here is probably another instance of the freedom taken by the author. He perhaps used some existing stories of heroic deeds to set a scene to convey his message. Some writers think that the name Bethulia may have been a symbolic meaning and have the sense of virgin, house of the Lord God, or a house of the ascent. So that's kind of where we are going with chapter 4 here. So going back to the beginning of chapter 4, Judah is on alert. It says, by this time the people of Israel living in Judea had heard of everything that Holofernes, the general, had done to the nations and how he had plundered and destroyed everything in their path and all their temples. They were therefore greatly terrified at his approach, were alarmed both for Jerusalem and for the temple of the Lord their God. They make a reference here in a couple of different places to the need for this little town to protect Jerusalem and the temple. They want to protect the temple of God. They were therefore very greatly terrified at his approach and were alarmed both for Jerusalem and for the temple, for they had only recently returned from their captivity. And all the people of Judea were newly gathered together, and the sacred vessels and the altar in the temple had been consecrated after their profanation, which happened when they got deported before. So they sent to every district of Samaria and to Kona and Beth-Horon and Belmain and Jericho and to Choba and Asura and the valley of Salem, and immediately seized all the high hilltops and fortified the villages on them and stored up food in preparation for war, since their fields had recently been harvested. So they had the harvest, they had the results of the harvest, they had food provisions. So they were trying to see what they could do to resist this huge army that they knew was coming at them. So they set up fortresses on the hills, which are easier to defend, and they set up all the food provisions so they could, you know, keep themselves from starving to death. And Joachim, the high priest, who was in Jerusalem at the time, wrote to the people of Bethulia and Betomethaim, I don't know how you pronounce that, which faces Estralion opposite the plain near Dothan, ordering them to seize the passes up into the hills, since by them Judea could be invaded. And it was easy to stop any who tried to enter, for the approach was narrow, only wide enough for two men at the most. So they're going to try to defend the passes as the path of invasion. So the Israelites did as Joachim the high priest and the senate of the whole people of Israel in session in Jerusalem had given order. So the high priest is acting kind of like a general. He's given the orders of what to do to defend against this invading army. So the high priest of God is the general on the Israelite side, and the Holofernes is the general on Nebuchadnezzar's side. It said, and every man of Israel cried out to God with great fervor, and they humbled themselves with much fasting, they and their wives and their children and their cattle, and every resident alien and hired laborer and purchased slave. They all girded themselves with sackcloth. And all the men and women of Israel and their children living in Jerusalem prostrated themselves before the temple and put ashes on their heads and spread out their sackcloth before the Lord. They even surrounded the altar with sackcloth and cried out in unison, praying earnestly to the God of Israel not to give up their infants as prey and their wives as booty, and the cities they had inherited to be destroyed and the sanctuary to be profaned and desecrated to the malicious joy of the Gentiles. So they're saying, please protect all these things. Protect our children, wives, our temple, everything that's sacred. Don't let it be taken by these people, these pagans. So the Lord heard their prayers and looked upon their affliction, for the people fasted many days throughout Judea and in Jerusalem before the sanctuary of the Lord Almighty. And Joachim the high priest and all the priests who stood before the Lord and ministered to the Lord with their loins girded with sackcloth offered the continual burnt offerings and the vows and freewill offerings of the people. With ashes upon their turbans, they cried out to the Lord with all their might to look with favor upon the whole house of Israel. So they're not sitting here trying to gather an army and weapons and chariots and everything else. They're praying and they're prostrating themselves before the Lord and saying, you know, please help us. We can't fight this big army ourselves. We can do some things. We can try to, you know, take the passes and protect them and all. But we're in danger. So they, you know, what they're doing is humbling themselves. And so when it talks about this, every man of Israel crying out to God with a great fervor, starting on verse 9 there, the notes they have here for verse 9 says they humbled themselves with much fasting. This literally means they humbled their souls with fervor. It's a way of saying they're in their very souls they're humble, and they're praying to God for help. It says the Greek translation of a Hebrew expression to do with fasting. The law prescribed fasting only for the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, but according to the teachings of the prophets, fasting as a sign of penance was linked to other forms of penance, such as prayer, the wearing of sackcloth, putting dust or ashes on one's head, sleeping on the floor. It was meant to show repentance and self-abasement. The prophet Isaiah reminds people that fasting is meant to show one is determined to avoid committing evil in Isaiah 58. In the post-exilic period, fasting became a common practice among devout Jews who fasted 2 days a week. We find traces of that custom in chapter 8, verses 5 and 6, and in Tobias 12:8 and Esther 4:16. When there was a threat of grave public calamity, people had recourse to fasting and prayer to implore God's mercy. So that's the notes they have there. So now we get to chapter 5. There's a fellow, Achior, who proclaims the greatness of the God of Israel. He's going to go to Holofernes and tell Holofernes, these guys have a God who's pretty powerful, so you better watch what you're doing. So it says, when Holofernes, the general of the Assyrian army, heard that the people of Israel had prepared for war, and he wasn't expecting that. He had just went right through everybody else. And now all of a sudden, these people are kind of girding up and preparing. So he's, you know, what do I do? What do I do now? So when he heard that the people of Israel prepared for war and had closed the passes in the hills and fortified all the high hilltops and set up barricades in the plains, he was very angry. So he called together all the princes of Moab and the commanders of Ammon and all the governors of the coastland and said to them, tell me, you Canaanites, what people is this that lives in this hill country? What cities do they inhabit? How large is their army? He's assuming they have an army. How large is their army, and in what does their power or strength consist? Who rules over them as king, leading their army? And why have they alone of all who live in the west refused to come out and meet me? So there was a fellow Achior. Then Achior, the leader of all the Ammonites, said to him, let my lord now hear a word from the mouth of your servant, and I will tell you the truth about this people that dwells in the nearby mountain district. No falsehood shall come from your servant's mouth. This people is descended from the Chaldeans. At one time they lived in Mesopotamia because they would not follow the gods of their fathers who were in Chaldea, for they had left the ways of their ancestors and they worshiped the God of heaven, the God they had come to know. Hence they drove them out from the presence of their gods and they fled to Mesopotamia and lived there for a long time. Then their God commanded them to leave the place where they were living and go to the land of Canaan. There they settled and prospered with much gold and silver and very many cattle. When a famine spread over Canaan, they went down to Egypt and lived there as long as they had food. And there they became a great multitude, so great that they could not be counted. So the king of Egypt became hostile to them. He took advantage of them and set them to making bricks and humbled them and made slaves of them. Then they cried out to their God, and he afflicted the whole land of Egypt with incurable plagues, and so the Egyptians drove them out of their sight. Then God dried up the Red Sea before them, and he led them by the way of Sinai and Kadesh Barnea, and drove out all the people of the wilderness. So they lived in the land of the Amorites, and by their might destroyed all the inhabitants of Heshbon. And crossing over the Jordan, they took possession of all the hill country and drove out before them the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Jebusites and the Shechemites and all the Jerusites and lived there a long time. As long as they did not sin against their God, they prospered, for the God who hates iniquity is with them. But when they departed from the way which he had appointed for them, they were utterly defeated in many battles and were led away captive to a foreign country. The temple of their God was razed to the ground and their cities were captured by their enemies. But now they have returned to their God and have come back from the place to which they were scattered and have occupied Jerusalem where their sanctuary is and have settled in the hill country because it was uninhabited. Now therefore, my master and Lord, if there is any unwitting error in this people, and they sin against their God, and we find out their offense, then we will go up and defeat them. But if there is no transgression in their nation, then let my Lord pass them by, for their Lord will defend them, and their God will protect them, and we shall be put to shame before the whole world. So he's kind of given Holofernes the history of the Jewish people, about their captivity in Egypt, about how Moses led them out, and all the plagues that God brought on Egypt, and everything else. And so he's saying, this God is really powerful. You don't want to mess with him, because look what he did. And so he's kind of given Holofernes a warning, but we saw how prideful Nebuchadnezzar and Holofernes were, or so. You know, is he going to pay attention? It says, when Achior had finished saying this, all the men standing around the tent began to complain. Holofernes' officers and all the men from the seacoast and from Moab insisted that he must be put to death. So they were ready to kill the messenger. that's an old story. Kill the messenger, but you don't like what he says. For they said, we will not be afraid of the Israelites. They are a people with no strength or power for making war. Therefore, let us go up, Lord Holofernes, and they will be devoured by your vast army. So then we get into chapter 6. When the disturbance made by the men outside the council died down, Holofernes, the commander of the Assyrian army, said to Achior and all the Moabites in the presence of all the foreign contingents. And who are you, Achior, and your hirelings of Ephraim, to prophesy among us as you have done today, and tell us not to make war against the people of Israel, because their God will defend them? Who is God except Nebuchadnezzar? He will send his forces and will destroy them from the face of the earth, and their God will not deliver them. we, the king's servants, will destroy them as one man. They cannot resist the might of our cavalry. We will burn them up, and their mountains will be drunk with their blood, and their fields will be full of their dead. They cannot withstand us, but will utterly perish. So says King Nebuchadnezzar, the Lord of the whole earth. For he has spoken, none of his words shall be in vain. But what are they going to do with Achior? Okay. But you, Achior, you Ammonite hireling, who have said these words on the day of your iniquity, you shall not see my face again from this day until I take revenge on this race that came out of Egypt. Then the sword of my army and the spear of my servants shall pierce your sides, and you shall fall among their wounded when I return. Now my slaves are going to take you back into the hill country and put you in one of the cities beside the passes, and you will not die until you perish along with them. If you really hope in your heart that they will not be taken, do not look downcast. I have spoken, and none of my words shall fail. So he's saying, if you believe that their God is going to protect them, you go with them, and he'll protect you too. But my army is going to come in there, and we're going to just run you through with swords and spears when we kill everybody else along with you. Then Holofernes ordered his slaves who waited on him in his tent to seize Achior and take him to Bethulia and hand him over to the men of Israel. So the slaves took him and led him out of the camp into the plain, and from the plain they went up into the hill country and came to the springs below Bethulia. When the men of the city saw them, they caught up their weapons and ran out of the city to the top of the hill, and all the slingers kept them from coming up by casting stones at them. However, they got under the shelter of the hill, and they bound Achior and left him lying at the foot of the hill and returned to their master. Then the men of Israel came down, found Achior, they untied him and brought him into Bethulia and placed him before the magistrates of the city, who in those days was Uzziah the son of Micah of the tribe of Simeon, and Chabris the son of Gothoniel, and Charmis the son of Melchiel. They called together all the elders and all the young men and the women and ran to the assembly, and they set Achior up in the midst of all the people, and they asked him what had happened. He answered and told them what had taken place at the council of Holofernes and all that he had said in the presence of the Assyrian leader and all the Holofernes had said boastfully against the house of Israel. Then the people fell down and worshiped God and cried out to him and said, O Lord, God of heaven, behold their arrogance and have pity on the humiliation of our people, and look this day upon the faces of those who are consecrated to thee. Then they consoled Achior and praised him greatly, and Uzziah took him from the assembly to his own house and gave a banquet for the elders, and all that night they called on the God of Israel for help. It's almost 10:30, so let's stop here. We'll pick up with chapter 7 next time. We're getting now to the second part of this story, where we're going to see how Judith comes into play, which he decides to do to save Israel, and see what's going to happen with all the people of Israel. What do you think of this story? Yeah, it's an interesting book. It does raise the question. Do you think? Well, we haven't got to chapter 9 yet, so I'm not going to ask that question. But think about whether you think they were justified in not including it in the Bible, that they had justification for making it one of the deuterocanonical books. So when we get to chapter 9, and looking at the complaint we saw earlier, we'll take a look at that and see whether those alleged falsehoods were really something that would keep it from being included in the Bible.
Okay.
it wasn't up until the Reformation. So, any other thoughts on this book?
Well, doesn't it show how you put your faith in God for you? They didn't want that included in their Bible. That's pretty sad.
Yeah, it is.
They feel that way.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
My goodness. Jim, one question. When you said land of Goshen, that land of Goshen, it sounds like that phrase when other folks would say, land of Goshen.
Yeah. That's right. Yep, that's right. That's exactly right. You, every now and then you'll see one of those kind of phrases like that in here, you know, that kind of brings to mind something else you've either seen or heard. But it's an interesting book, and you can see the religious significance of this book. You know, with somebody, you know, God has always fought against idolatry. One of the big sins of Israel was that they would be influenced by the nations that surrounded them, and they would start worshiping the gods of those nations. And every time they started to get into idolatry, God would move back away from them, stop protecting them, and then some enemy would come in and take over. We saw it with the Babylonian exile, and we saw it with the Assyrian exile. It's usually, you know, the sins of Israel, especially idolatry, that causes those things to happen to them. As long as Israel stayed faithful, God protected them. So it's interesting. Any other thoughts?
I'm hoping that the example of what's happening with our country right now.
Yeah. That's exactly.
Yeah, I was thinking this.
Bringing it back to God.
Yep, I was thinking the same thing as I was reading through this. You know, you see so much going on. You know, I just saw a thing on the internet this week about some school district in Illinois is encouraging 5-year-old kids to join the Satan Club.
Yeah, the Satan Club?
Yeah, it's just...
sick.
It's just really sick, you know? When a school district, a public school district, is encouraging 5-year-old kids to join a Satan Club. And the school's defending that.
Right.
They're, you know, they got a lot of complaints from parents about it, and the school's defending it. You know, it's just, you know, I pray every day that God will help us and get rid of this evil that has infected this country the way it has. My only hope for the United States is that there are enough people that love God and believe in God and want to, you know, be faithful to Him and overcome the evil that's going on right now. I pray every day that God sends His angels through this country to rid us of the infection of evil that's happening, like this thing with the kids, you know, and all the other problems. It's just, you know, we are not what God wanted us to be when He caused our foundation. And it's true of the rest of the world, too.
What they're indoctrinating our kids with.
Yeah. Well, it's happening all over the... It's happening all over the place, though. It's not just the United States. You know, France is called the mother country of the church, and yet look what's happening there. You know, the number of people that actually go to Mass on Sunday is down to like 7% or less. You know, it's really sad. All over Europe, the European Union is trying to wipe out the Christian heritage from their, you know, policies and everything else. It's all over the place. It's not just here.
It's all over the world.
Yep. So we need to pray.
Did you see that Poland is about the only place that has
what,
Yeah, it could be. It could be. A lot of Poles. You know, Poland is a lot of Jews and a lot of Catholics. Hopefully it was enough there to save Europe.
You know, we have to keep praying.
Yep. When Father Blum was here, he talked a lot about the Blessed Mother's attempt to save us with her flame of love. He talked about that flame of love devotion. It's an interesting book. If you get the diary and read it, it's really interesting. And she says in there that her flame of love is Jesus Christ. So she wants to spread the grace of his love, of Christ, to all of humanity, and says that it'll blind Satan when we do this. And we need to blind Satan, because there's just too much evil everywhere. So we got to pray more. Pray and fast.
Exactly. He said one rosary a day wasn't enough. We need to pray two and three rosaries a day.
Yep. We got to do a lot of prayer. A lot of prayer, a lot of fasting.
Amen.
Okay. Well, we'll see you next week. Anybody have anything else they want to cover before we leave for the day? Okay. Well, have a great week, and we'll see you. There's another storm coming in next Sunday, so we'll have to see where we end up next week. But anyway, have a great week.
Well, thanks, Jim.
See you guys.
Have a blessed week.
See you.
Thank you. God bless.
God bless everybody.